Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's Australian Open semi-finals catch-up, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com.
Tsitsipas sets up a finals date with Novak Djokovic.
Rybakina looks to become a double slam champion.
And Sabalenka secures her maiden major singles final.
Kim, Chris, today is the 27th of January and we are here to catch up on the semi-finals of the Australian Open at Tennis Weekly HQ. We now have our finalists set. Stefanos Tsitsipas and Novak Djokovic are in the men's final and we have Elena Rybakina and Aryna Sabalenka in the ladies' singles final. We've of course got some controversy to talk about with Novak Djokovic's dad. But before we get into all that, Chris, I've got to ask. I know I'm on tenterhooks. I know Kim's on tenterhooks. And I know all of our listeners are on tenterhooks. We spoke about you going to the cinema at the start of our last episode. We had to record 15 minutes early. Was it? I really hope it was worth it. So was it?
Well, I have to disappoint you there, Joel. The subtitles were in Danish. I watched an English film, which defeats the purpose of living in Copenhagen.
I feel robbed.
Wanted to be... Yeah, I mean, so do I, Joel. I mean, we can both relate on that one. But it was very, very long and quite difficult to follow. And it related to culinary experiences called The Menu. So had an audience rating of 3.5 and a critics rating that's very high. So I think maybe... I fell into the audience category there, but far too long. And I'm sorry I made you start 15 minutes earlier.
Was it longer or shorter than Novak Djokovic against Tommy Paul? That is the question.
Double the length
of that match, right? Well, on that note.
We're already on the Tommy Paul bashing, I feel. Like, no one gave him a chance. Even when I gave him
Rightly
a chance
so.
And said Djokovic in four, you all laughed at me and... The Tommy Paul bashing, I think we have to give him his due. He got to a Grand Slam semi-final.
He may never again. No, I mean, that is harsh. It would have been interesting against a different opponent, but Novak Djokovic is the 9-times champion. It's the last person you want to play in an Australian Open semi-final.
He is just making all of his matches uninteresting at the moment, isn't he? Or at least his last three opponents, Demonor, Rublev and now Paul, they've just all really crumbled, haven't they, when they've stepped onto the court?
Well, at 1-5 though, I have to say, he was 1-5 down in the first set, got it back to 5-all. So there was at least a set of entertaining tennis today where he didn't make it quite as straightforward, a little wobble.
But then, you know, after that little wobble, he lost just three games and was significantly, you know, outclassed Tommy Paul. My parents were texting me on the old WhatsApp saying, this is bad for tennis. This is bad for tennis. There's no competition. It's not really sort of interesting, is it? Hopefully the final will be a bit closer. Hopefully a lot closer. We'll get onto that in a bit. But Djokovic does have quite a good record in Australian Open semi-finals, and obviously every time he gets there he goes on to win the tournament. But actually, Joel, you raise an interesting point before we started recording. His last four semi-final opponents have been, I would say, not whom you would expect in a semi-final, or have been significantly hampered, haven't they, once Djokovic has got to this stage?
Yeah, because obviously we have Tommy Paul this year, Aslan Karatsev in 2021, Lucas Pouille as well in 2019. And we had, in between there, we had an injured sort of knee injury, Roger Federer. I thought it was interesting because obviously you're a big Rafa fan and I feel like there's a lot of, like, tension and annoyance, I think, at some of the, questioning the calibre and the quality of some of the semi-final opponents that Novak Djokovic has had over the years. And, you know, whether that stat on semi-finals and finals is perhaps inflated by the lack of quality of opponents, arguably, that he's had to face. I mean, where do you stand on that in relation to kind of Rafa and the opponents he's had to face, I feel, in semi-finals?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always instances where you just get, you know, the top seeds and someone's come through the draw and they just sort of freeze when they, you know, come up against the defending champion top seed, you know, one of the big three. And it just doesn't make for a very interesting or exciting match. Doesn't always happen like that, but certainly I think Rafa's had his fair share of kind of lower ranked opponents at the latter stages. And yeah, it's unfortunate for neutrals or people who want a closer affair, but I think probably the big three have all benefited from that throughout their career, whether it's at Roland Garros or AO. So I don't think necessarily Djokovic has had that more than maybe Rafa or any of the others. I think it kind of does the rounds. It's sort of part of how the draws pan out sometimes. But yeah, it's just certainly the last four that Novak's had have been not his most difficult matches. Let's just say that much.
I mean, I feel like he was trying to make it, particularly in that first set, a difficult match for him, because I mean the stats at the end of it weren't actually that pretty, I think, for Novak Djokovic. I know we talk about his last few matches have all been straight sets, have been very easy. But he produced quite a lot of unforced errors in that first set. Made it interesting. Yes, it could have been much easier than it was. It surprised me there was that like blip there. I think he maybe got he lost his concentration, and as a result that the errors started to creep in. I think he was getting frustrated on court, but I guess that is the only sort of ray of light or positivity I think you can take from the performance, maybe going into the final, that Djokovic maybe still has those lapses in concentration when he thinks he's so far ahead and it doesn't seem like it's possible for him to lose. Actually, is that a moment where he is actually a bit vulnerable?
It's got to give you some hope, because the numbers, as you say, were not good in that first set. Just having a quick look, there were 12 winners to 24 unforced errors, very uncharacteristic of Djokovic. And Tommy Paul didn't play a good set either to get himself back into it. He had 8 winners to 19 unforced errors. So it's definitely a case that you will have chances. There could be chances, I should say, not you will, because I think Alex de Minaur would beg to differ.
There could be chances if Djokovic drops his level.
And also, Tommy Paul didn't necessarily lift his level based on some of the stats from that first set. It was kind of a both of them sort of going off the boil a bit, I think, and obviously playing a bit more of a, running a bit more of a tighter ship for Tommy Paul in that one. But again, I mean, if you took the scenario of a 7-5 first set, I think Tommy Paul would be relatively pleased that he made it competitive. But it's a shame that after that, Djokovic just ran away with it and his numbers improved dramatically.
I mean, one person we didn't see in this match was Djokovic's dad, who had decided whether through his own choice or someone else's not to attend the match. And that was because after his previous rounds match, his win over Rublev, Djokovic's dad, Surgeon, had been seen posing for photographs with Serbian fans who had Russian flags carrying a face of Vladimir Putin and the pro-war symbols, which obviously is not a good look. There shouldn't even be Russian flags at the site at the Australian Open, all this sort of activity going on. And, Novak Djokovic's father being seen with these people, obviously an awful look for Novak Djokovic, having a close family member getting involved in this. We don't really know the ins and outs of it. The Australian Open have obviously briefed players and their teams to follow the policies regarding flags and not to sort of get involved with anything. His dad came out with a statement to sort of say he didn't mean to cause any disruption and that he was just outside with Novak's fans, didn't want to get caught up in anything, and we only want piece, blah, blah, blah. Usual kind of PR statement stuff. But he said, I didn't want to cause any disruption to the semis, to the semi-final, so I won't be watching live. So obviously this does nothing to help Novak Djokovic's reputation, which at the best of times is a bit tricky. Chris, what did you make of the sort of pictures and scenes that we saw that sort of came out after the quarterfinal?
I do think it's completely inexcusable. I mean, it wasn't like he wouldn't necessarily be aware of what the Russian flag looked like. It also had a picture of Putin on the flag. So even going up to them or speaking to them is particularly concerning. The intention or the sympathy behind that and what that communicates is certainly very troublesome. Again, they should not have even been able to be in a space where he would have been. That's the only defense I can give there. But not necessarily a rare moment of sympathy for Djokovic for me, but it's something where his parents don't tend to make situations better for him on his return to Australia, having kind of, we thought it would be plain sailing after Adelaide. He was welcomed in Melbourne. And it's almost like his dad just has managed to kind of find a very
inopportune out of the water. Time.
I mean, he has completely. And now we're back onto the old Djokovic family are a problem. And the narrative is very much around that. I mean, his mother has also been very outspoken. I mean, she actually said that the Australian government were torturing him last year when he was being detained. So I think it's one where Djokovic might be a master of kind of saying the right thing from a PR perspective on this tour, but it seems like not everyone was in the same press briefing.
Yeah, he's had a lot of issues with his parents before, hasn't he? And I remember the early days that they used to sort of sit in the box wearing the same T-shirts and kind of standing up and being, I would say, quite sort of aggressive at times, actually. And then I think Djokovic at the time, I may be wrong, sort of told them to tone it down a bit, because I think a lot of people found it a bit unseemly.
I think Federer told them to tone it down as well one time.
Yeah, quite right.
That famous clip, be quiet.
Be quiet, said to them. Yeah. So this isn't the first time, you know, we've seen his parents kind of causing disruption for him. But it's not a good look. It won't do anything to help his reputation, especially not in Australia or worldwide. But
do you think with, you know, his dad chose himself to not be at the semi-finals, and we don't know, as you said, whether that was his decision, whether Novak Djokovic had a word with his dad, or even if Tennis Australia, you know, got involved and said, you know, this is too risky now for you to turn up. What do you think, you know, happens in the final? Do you think his dad will have to stay at home again, or do you think it would be fine for him to, you know, be in the box cheering on his son? I mean, it's going to be potentially a historic moment for Novak Djokovic. It could be a time when he, you know, reaches 10 singles titles down under. That could be a monumental moment. You know, family members would not want to miss out on that. So I feel like his dad is probably wanting to be there and feels compelled to be there. But do you expect to see that happen now?
I think he'll be there. I think Djokovic isn't necessarily known to sort of cave to public pressure. Obviously, last year with the we're still talking about it. Unfortunately, the vaccination question. It would have been very easy not to necessarily take that into the legal process that it went down and just said, you know what, this is I don't want to get involved in this. And so I think it's a case that he would have then played despite the public outcry being against him if he had been allowed to. So I think it's one where it's advisable that he probably wouldn't attend. But I think from a personal perspective, I think he probably would be willing to take the heat because he's kind of experienced it before. And I think they're hoping that sitting out the semi-final will kind of appease the people who were
Do you not think it's a safety risk, though?
I mean, it potentially, but I think if he is not there, it will not be a Djokovic camp decision. I think it will be an AO decision. That would be, whether we find out if it is or not, I don't know. We probably would if it was the AO that stopped him from being there. But I think he shouldn't be there. I think that's actually completely against the rules of the tournament and the spirit of which tournaments like this are played, and keeping it to be a safe environment for players.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it would be better if he wasn't there. I think
that's
the spirit of the tournament. I think, yeah, I just But, you know, maybe that will put Novak off, perhaps. Maybe that will be the... I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to suggest anything, but...
I do think it has opened up a conversation that I think needs maybe addressing is the role of flags and tennis and supporters, you know, bringing flags into events. Now, I know some events I feel like are not bothered by it. And then you get events, you know, I've been going to Wimbledon for years and they are not keen on fans bringing flags in. Now, you know, Russians and Belarusians, they do not have a flag at the moment. When you see on TV, it's just kind of a white space. Do you think this opens up the conversation on should tennis be a nationalistic sport? If we're banning like Russian flags, for example, and they're not able to do that properly because we're seeing them get into arenas, then should we just have a blanket rule that says, sorry, everyone, we can't do this at the moment, so therefore we're just gonna remove all flags and arguably, you know, keep that maybe to Davis Cup, Billie Jean King Cup, but on the tour, this is not you playing for your nation.
I mean, flags are just political in their essence, really, aren't they? I mean, you can read into flags politically if you want to. So allowing some flags and not others, obviously, I don't agree that Russian flags should be allowed. I think it's right to ban them, but you could go the whole hog and ban all flags, not just sort of now, but just maybe. If you, I don't know, I don't think it's necessarily, I mean, I'd quite like to be able to bring a Spanish flag in if I want to support Rafa, for example. So I don't think that's necessarily the right way to go. Just you kind of hope that there are rules in place to maintain respect around symbols and flags. I think with Wimbledon, it's more, it's big flags is the issue. So you can take small ones in. It's just the big ones. I don't want people waving, blocking viewpoints.
Yeah, I think it's, the problem also happens in terms of how the rules are interpreted, because there has been incidents such as in Cincinnati when a Ukrainian fan was actually removed from the site for having the Ukrainian flag whilst watching an all-Russian tennis match. And so I think it's this thing where it's becoming an issue, and it's becoming more politicized around those, obviously, the flags of those that are associated with the war. And so I think it's very different, and the context is very different at different times. Like, I feel like in America, you cannot have a rule about kind of taking someone's flag away from them. That would be completely unacceptable, and it would only kind of incite further anger. So I think it's a case where this should not have been allowed to happen. And I don't think it's necessarily the fact that flags are the issue. I think it's the demonstrating support for the conflict, and the Z symbol was on the flags and so was Putin, and that made it even more clear that this was something that wasn't just supporting someone from the Russian Tennis Federation. It was much more something that was made to make a political statement and a disturbance.
Yeah, I mean, let's see what happens. Let's see if Surgeon's going to be at the final. But I mean, looking at the final itself, it will be Djokovic against Stefanos Tsitsipas, because Tsitsipas came through against Karen Khachanov in four sets, which I think some of us predicted. So both semis kind of went, I think, as most of us predicted. Tsitsipas into his second Grand Slam final, and yet again he will face Novak Djokovic. But looking back at the semi itself, it was 7-6, 6-4, 6-7, 6-3. So very close to being three straight sets. But Tsitsipas, you know, he had two match points in that third set, wasn't able to get it done, Khachanov clinching it. But Tsitsipas went off court, had a little break, back onto court, quickly went a break up and got the job done. Joel, what did you make of this match? And going into the final, do you think Tsitsipas, based on what you've seen, you know, has any chance?
Yeah, he did really well, I think, to regroup actually in that fourth set. I didn't think there was much he could do in the tiebreak on those match points. Khachanov just raised his level, hit a very, very good forehand down the line winner on one of them, and was able to nab it. So it was impressive, I think, to see Tsitsipas go off, collect himself, come back on, and get back to business as usual. There was also an incredible point, I think at 4-all in the second set, which Khachanov was trying to put away a series of smashes that Tsitsipas was getting back, and eventually won the point with a big forehand. And, you know, I was impressed generally by his defensive capabilities, his movement around the court. I could see what Khachanov was trying to do in terms of using angles and moving his opponent about. But Tsitsipas just seemed to have so much time on the ball when he was moving towards shots. I mean, his forehand as well was in a very, very imperious and commanding fashion. And I think for me, the question going into the final will be, how much of Tsitsipas can he insert of his game onto Novak Djokovic? Because I think in this match against Karen Khachanov, he was allowed, you know, over the majority of the match, he was allowed to do that. I'm not sure if Novak Djokovic is going to afford him the same privilege that Karen Khachanov did.
Chris, what do you think? Do you think there's any leeway for Tsitsipas to kind of get close in the final? I mean, do you think that French Open final they played, where Tsitsipas was two sets up and lost in five, is that going to weigh on his mind coming into this? Do you think that's going to, is there sort of damage done to the psyche of Tsitsipas still festering perhaps from that final?
Well, I'll tell you something that was quite interesting that I saw today was that in an interview when Djokovic was asked about playing Tsitsipas in the final, he actually was quoted as saying, "He's never made the finals of a Grand Slam. Am I wrong?" Completely forgetting on Djokovic's part that he actually played him and was down two sets to love in Paris in 2021. To which Tsitsipas replied that he'd actually forgotten about it as well, which I think that might be wishful thinking. But it's clearly not weighing on Djokovic's mind. And I think maybe those comments might just kind of make Tsitsipas kind of remember a bit more. But I would say it's good that he's had that experience in a final, would be the positive side of it, that he was able to go out there and start a final really well. I think when it gets close, that might be something where it could become a bit dicey. But I think Tsitsipas is playing differently to how he played last year. The basics of his game are working really well. He had 18 aces. He was doing really well behind his first serve, winning 84% of points. And then his numbers on winners to errors, it was almost double, 66 winners to 34 unforced errors. So this isn't Tsitsipas playing a little bit defensively or not going for his backhand and kind of overusing the slice like we've seen him do sometimes on the return and blocking returns. This is much more aggressive against an already aggressive baseliner. So I think he's in a better position to challenge Djokovic than he was in 2021 in the final in Paris. But I do think it will be a tall order. But I actually think that this one, I'm not sure which way I would call this, because I do think that Djokovic is the favourite. But we've seen very strange things in finals, like that Medvedev US Open. We've seen kind of there are moments when maybe he isn't as kind of clear thinking in finals. He's made it sometimes a bit more difficult, such as 2021 Roland Garros. So I think it's not as clear cut as we think, and it's definitely it's not a case of a Tommy Paul versus Novak Djokovic situation. I think this will be maybe even five sets. I think it will be really a tough one, and I'm not sure I want to give a prediction.
Kim, you raised a good point actually, because there is history, I guess, on the line here. And you could look back to that US Open final against Medvedev when, you know, he had the chance of holding all four Grand Slams in the calendar year, and he just buckled under that pressure. So is there, you know, an argument to say that, given, you know, what is on the line here, the fact that he could also move equal with Nadal in terms of overall number of Grand Slam titles, do you think that would potentially weigh on him and potentially upset his performance?
Yeah, I think obviously that final with Daniil Medvedev, the US Open 2021, we didn't really see the Novak Djokovic we expect, and that was because he was going for all four slams in the calendar year. I think he was going for the most slams ever, and that seemed to get to him and freeze him up somewhat. I think going for it to kind of equal a record is different to going to break it, so I don't expect him to be in the same, like, maybe sort of mental rut that he might have been in that final. But perhaps it could well do. But I I don't think so. I think that was quite a unique circumstance because it was almost two records on the line then. And we know how mentally strong Djokovic is generally. It's very, very rare that we see a blip. Like, we see him getting a bit annoyed and rattled, but generally he'll pull it together and come out, you know, ever so strong. So it was something that was running through my mind, but I don't think in this scenario it's going to have as much of an impact personally.
Yeah, I think, yes, it's tough. I did enjoy, though, Karen Khachanov in his press conference after the Tsitsipas match saying maybe Tsitsipas should give Daniil Medvedev a call and ask him what he did on that day at the US Open. And I just thought, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen based on the frostiness of their, I think, relationship between,
Or if it does happen, I'm not sure he'll give you the right answer.
Or I just don't think that Daniil Medvedev would pick up the phone. Or he'd put it down straight away.
Probably. There would be no one would answer that call.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I'm still going to... Yeah, Djokovic, hands down, sort of favourite for me. It would be interesting to see how close Tsitsipas can try to get it. But... Yeah, I think it's just going to be Tsitsipas again being almost the nearly man. I mean, he hasn't beaten Djokovic since 2019 at the Paris Masters. You know, they've had a couple of five-setters in that time. But the last few times they've played, it's... Well, you know, last year in Paris, it did come down to a last-set tiebreak. But I can't see it over five sets, given their, you know, given Novak on this court, you know, he's very much at home. He's going for his 10th title. So... yeah, it's the final we all predicted. That's all we can say. We can at least be smug about
we
that.
We can say that, exactly.
Yes, well done, everyone.
On that smug note, let's have a very quick break, but we'll be back in the second half looking at both of the ladies' semifinals, so do not go anywhere.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Tennis Weekly, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. Now we're going to move on to look at the ladies' semi-finals, which saw Elena Rybakina against Victoria Azarenka and also Magda Linette against Aryna Sabalenka.
Do we have to look back on that one?
What? Linette Sabalenka? Is that because GoatNet is over, Joel?
The GoatNet train, yes.
Well, as you've mentioned that, let's start with Magda Linette and Aryna Sabalenka. Because, yeah, as we've alluded to, Magda Linette is well and truly out now of the Australian Open. Her dream run has come to an end at the hands of Sabalenka.
I wanted it to end after that first game when she broke Sabalenka. And I think everyone's eyebrows were maybe raised to be like, oh, OK, this might be happening.
It wasn't going to get any better for Linette.
No, that, unfortunately not. Yeah.
Well, she wasn't fazed, though, was she? She got off to really, really good start breaking in that first game, and you know, that which was great to see that she wasn't sort of in. You know, sometimes players get to the, you know, their only Grand Slam semi final, and well, they've never been at that stage before, and they just self combust. So, you know, she was very unfazed by it all. But Sabalenka really just doing what she has been doing this whole year so far and coming through in straight sets and being proving far too strong on the day. Chris, what did you make of this encounter?
Well, I did see, you know, the early break going to Linette, and I thought, hang on a minute, maybe all of Joel's dreams will come true. and that then he can keep using GoatNet long into the weekend, potentially. But unfortunately, that phrase will have to be retired unless kind of another dream run goes on. But no, I think it was a better contest than in that first set than I think some of us might have predicted. I think it was good to see that Lynette made the most of the opportunity that she had by kind of, she broke in early on. You know, she wasn't intimidated by the situation. And when she got broken back, she stayed really competitive all the way to the tiebreak. I actually think the standard of both semifinals, despite being straight sets, was very high. I think it was a great kind of platform for women's tennis because it was really strong play from everyone. And it was very, very competitive, even though the sets did go kind of all in the same way of one player in each semi. But I think the level was great. I think Sabalenka, it only reaffirms the fact that she is a different player when it comes to those clutch moments. Only two double faults, which is almost unbelievable. But even in those kind of clutch moments in that first set, you know, she's been in semifinals before and they've run away from her to steady the ship and then almost bulldoze her way through in that second set. I think, yeah, it's very impressive that she, don't let her get ahead of you is all I can say.
Yeah, she didn't panic, I think, in that first set when, yeah, perhaps she was going in expecting it to be maybe a bit of a stroll, but, you know, she really stepped it up, I think, in that tiebreak and didn't look back. So I think you can see the confidence that she's playing with, and maybe she didn't start the way she wanted to start, but I think what pleased me was how she didn't let that eat into her game. She didn't worry, she didn't panic, and it eventually a power, I think, just kind of ultimately overwhelmed Lynette. And although she was doing her best, it was really hard for her to, I think, assert her game when Sabalenka was just hitting winners, you know, from the baseline.
Winners for fun almost, Joel. But the question I ask you, given your love of Magda, is how will this year go for her? Where do you think you'll see her ranked, and will she be taking home a Grand Slam and overtaking Iga in the rankings? What do we think?
Well, I think she can certainly close the gap with Iga Świątek in terms of rankings. I think, you know, this has been an amazing run from her. I think she can certainly work her way up the rankings and, you know, win a title on the tour. I think she's got an all-court game that, again, I think suit her well across the whole season. I just see her being very kind of consistent with standout results here and there. And I think this will be, of course, one of the standout results of her season this year, but also probably of her career as well.
Yeah, I think it's. I don't know if it's going to lead to her suddenly progressing up the rankings or if it's just a one-off, because we do see, you know, that sometimes players don't go on after this sort of deep run at a slam.
I would like to see her work more with Agnieszka Radwanska, because I think they have been working, you know, I've seen, you know, been seeing on the TV Radwanska in the crowd, I think in Lynette's box actually, you know, this week. And I think that's a really nice, you know, partnership.
And on the courts,
there.
Joel.
And
she's
on the,
been
well,
on the
exactly,
courts as well.
Yeah, in the ladies, what, Masters doubles, yes.
Legends, yes, picking up the title with Hanchikova.
But I
we
do,
love to see it.
I do like that sort of dynamic there, and I wonder if, yeah, there's opportunities for Radwanska to come into Lynette's team a bit more, because I think that's been very fruitful this tournament.
So the other semi-final, we saw Elena Rybakina, the Wimbledon champion of last year, up against Vika Azarenka, former champion, former two-time AO champion. I thought in my predictions that I think Azarenka might have come through this in three sets, perhaps. I thought we were going to see a resurgence, her winning the title maybe 10 years on from her last, but it was not to be, because Rybakina came through in straight sets in the end. Quite a sort of up and down first set. I think Azarenka went a break up, Rybakina broke back, then broke again to serve for it. Couldn't do so. It all went to a tie break, which she did get the job done eventually. Then she went an early break up in the second and managed to close it out 6-3 in that set in the end to edge out Azarenka. Chris, what did you make of this one and Rybakina's performance? Did it live up to the billing of this match and these two opponents going to head to head?
I think the only thing, and obviously I've said this before, that it didn't live up to was that third set. It was pitched as the ultimate battle between the best server on the WTA, arguably at the moment, especially at this tournament, versus one of the best returners I think we've ever seen in the game. So it did lend itself very nicely to that. And the stats do show that the numbers on the serve and the return were very much typical of that, that Azarenka was able to get a lot more balls back in court than some of Rybakina's opponents that she's played so far. I think there were moments when Rybakina's level was just scary high. And I think the biggest difference that I've seen compared to kind of the Wimbledon performance last year is that she has made these improvements in her game, especially her movement. Her footwork, when she's lining up for her backhand, which is her biggest weapon, was almost like pinpoint. And she was winning points that she wasn't necessarily in the position to win previously, because you could take her kind of out wide and she might have to kind of go for broke, but she was getting herself back in and winning some of the longer points. So I think it showed great improvement from her. I think for the Azarenka side of things, she is able to play at that level, but it's very hard to play at that level for, you know, an hour and a half. And there were moments when her focus was so locked in and she was hitting these fantastic shots, but it's just a couple here and there that can make the difference. And the final thing I'll say on Rybakina is that she did start going very big, and then she kind of just took some pace off the ball as the match went on, which I thought was tactically quite interesting, because we know that Azarenka really enjoyed playing Serena and someone who hits the ball very hard, and it felt like she was just kind of taking away
playing within some herself of the pace a little bit.
And then the ball wasn't coming back so quickly at her, giving her more time. So I think it was quite interesting that she went from trying to hit her off the court to actually hanging in the points a bit longer, which is kind of a really big change in her game.
Do you think she can do this a similar thing against Sabalenka and disrupt her?
I think she probably could. I think it will need to be more front foot tennis than against Azarenka. I think you've got to get that strike in, so that it's going to be first strike tennis. Whoever gets that first one in will get the upper hand in the point. I think it will be a challenge. I think that we did ask the question kind of on the social feeds as to who we thought would get this one, and people are leaning towards Rybakina for this one, which I was slightly surprised by the weighting of that. I think it was 63% of people think that Rybakina will get the win here. Oh, 65%, sorry. And you can see why, because she has got all the weapons. One final thing I will say is that it's very interesting that if she is to win Rybakina, then it'll be the first time that two players have split the Grand Slams since the end of 2003, when it was Serena and Justin Ennen that split them. So that could be an interesting rivalry moving forward of Iga and Elena, but that would be a bit of a turn up for the books in recent years for the WTA.
It would be, wouldn't it? I was thinking that that would be quite, you know, the last four slams all being taken by just two players. And I agree actually with our poll, I think, because Rybakina has got that slam under her belt. I'd have to go with that extra bit of experience in the finals. I know Sabalenka's been playing, you know, lights out all year, but I do think that just being a champion already stands for an awful lot.
Do you find it surprising we're talking about Rybakina in the final? I know she's come through. I mean, I look at her journey actually to the final, and it's impressive. She's had to, you know, knock out quite a few, you know, previous Grand Slam champions: Azarenka, Ostapenko, Świątek. But you know, she came into this season, I think she lost, similar to Azarenka, I think she lost both her in the first round of her warm up events, was 0-2.
She actually did win her first round in Adelaide.
Oh, sorry.
Where she beat Danielle Collins, who he played again, and then she lost to Marta Kostyuk in Adelaide 1.
Sorry, right. But I guess my point is, are you surprised that after Wimbledon, I feel like she went in, we didn't really hear much about her. It wasn't like she continued, I think, that momentum and you know, picked up, you know, a few tour titles. Do you think she just has like a really big game for Grand Slams, and that makes her a threat and really, really dangerous, you know, regardless of what form she's showing on the tour?
She's a player who, I read an article actually whilst I was on a flight yesterday from her coach, and he was explaining that I think they take a really interesting approach to her development, where they're more focused on the gains that she'll make off the court, in terms of she's now lifting weight, she's now doing some different training, she's working on her footwork, really working on her forehand, working on moving forward in the court. So I think it was a case where the early losses, I think, is more because she's finally had a training block post the Wimbledon roller coaster, and then obviously not a great lead-in to the hard court season, where coming into this season in Australia, I think she's trying to put some of those new things into play. And so I think it's more about learning on the court and getting better as a whole rather than just getting wins, so that you are in a better position when you are in the slam. So I think she's actually timed it pretty well that she's tried out some new things. She's getting used to the new game she has in competition. And she's obviously a big match player. And I think that's something which was underrated on the tour, because I think we've had a lot of people, especially on the men's side, who aren't big match players. And I think it's great that she can show kind of a lot of people that almost that Serena Williams approach, where you don't have to be in form because you've got the game to challenge anyone, I think is very dangerous in her.
So who do you think has the bigger game going into the finals, Sabalenka or Rybakina? Because they both hit a pretty mean ball.
I would have to say the thud that you hear when Rybakina connects with that backhand is something else. I think the topspin, there's a bit more topspin on some of Sabalenka's shots. She plays closer to the lines at the back sometimes. I think if I had to say, I think the noise that you get from a Rybakina shot is just a little bit more kind of a bit louder, a bit scarier, I'd say. But the physical presence of Sabalenka, I think she has a bigger stature.
Yeah, I'd say Sabalenka definitely is more intimidating, I think, on a tennis court. But as you said, the shots and the power that Rybakina possesses can be at times really, really hard to stop.
Yeah, I think it is a close one. I think purely because of the aggression given in performance, I feel like Sabalenka is. Mm. But that's because I think just her persona around the game.
The grunting.
Yes.
The effort.
I think it adds extra force, whereas Rybakina is a bit more, not sedate, but she's just a bit more like contained, isn't she? And therefore, I guess it's almost like more of a stealthy kind of,
silent assassin.
Yeah, exactly right. So that's my take. But maybe we should do some predictions for the final or both finals. So let's go through how many sets and what's your winner, Chris? Rybakina, Sabalenka, tell us.
I think it's going to be Rybakina, and I'm going to say in two.
Joel?
Rybakina in three.
Oh, I'm going to go for Rybakina in three as well.
Ooh.
I can't believe
all of us are going for Rybakina. That's quite surprising because Sabalenka's obviously not dropped a set, but we've all turned our back on her.
It's hard because the form, and Sabalenka's not dropped a set yet this season.
This year.
Yeah, it's great. It's really impressive.
But if she does drop a set, how would you respond? That might be also interesting,
right? I think you look at the quality of opponents that Rybakina has had to face at this Australian Open, and I would say it's been higher.
Higher,
than what
I
Sabalenka
agree.
Yeah, and she's had really good game plans as well, I think. Mm. She really executed her game plans well, I think, rather than Sabalenka, where it's kind of she's almost just stuck to plan A until it started working.
Yeah, I agree. Well, so that's the women. Djokovic against Tsitsipas. Joel, tell us.
Djokovic in four.
Four, interesting. Chris?
I am going to take a different approach. Everything that I think has happened or I've said out loud hasn't happened. So I'm going to say, what do I think might not happen, which will be correct. So I'm going to say Tsitsipas in five.
I'm going to go Djokovic in three. I've got no faith.
Wow.
Will he get more games than Tommy Paul, Kim? That's the question.
Oh, yes, for sure. I think so. I don't think it's going to be an obliteration, but strange things have happened. Yeah, I think there might be a tie break. I think it might be a 7-5, 6-4 job, but I don't think ones and twos. So we'll be back on Sunday to wrap up the outcome of those finals, see how accurately those predictions turn out in the end. Also, we'll have some doubles results to wrap up, as well as the results from the wheelchair events.
And collect a set.
Yeah, we'll be getting in touch with the players, including myself, for whom the tiebreak question applies. So do look out
for... Had to put it in there, Kim, didn't you?
Yeah. maybe I'll end up winning something. Won't get that wooden spoon. We did have a mixed doubles final, though, didn't we, that took place already. And we did have a win in that for Matos and Stefani, Brazilian pairing, who have teamed up this year for the first time. And they are 7-0 for this year. They won both their matches at the United Cup and here as well. So they beat Bapana and Sanja Mirza to get that mixed doubles title. So good on them. And maybe Sabalenka will continue her unbeaten run as well as the Brazilians.
Yeah, I think that's a shame for Mirza, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is she retiring after this tournament?
She is. And what's really nice about this is that her first ever mixed doubles partner was Bapana 22 years ago. Wow. When she was 14.
Wow.
And
wow.
He's now, I think he's 42 or something. So I'm not sure how they managed it. Maybe everyone just thought, they're so likable, maybe we'll let them get through to the final.
That is very impressive.
Matos and Stefani were like, no way. are we losing this opportunity? But still great that you can bow out, you know, still showing that you've got the game to challenge the best in mixed doubles.
Yes, and we're going to see who's going to bring their A game in the finals on our finals catch up on Sunday. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action to come in Melbourne.
We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Tennis Weekly Pod. You can email us on tennisweeklypod@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our website, www.tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we will be back on Sunday at Tennis Weekly HQ for our finals round by round catch up. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.